TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Robert Fisk on the War on Iraq. This is part two of a one-hour speech by the War and Middle East correspondent of the London-based Independent. Robert Fisk lives in Beirut and has covered the war in Lebanon, the Israel-Palestine conflict, the Iranian Revolution, the war in Afghanistan, the Gulf War, and Yugoslavia. He is the recipient of 21 British and Foreign Press Awards and was chosen as Correspondent of the Year 6 times. His straightforward and candid reporting has made him many enemies. Among reporters, he holds a record of sorts for the number of death threats that he has received. In part one, he spoke about U.S. plans to redraw the borders in the Middle East, not just in Iraq, and about his most recent interview of Osama bin Laden. Now Fisk will take you to Iraq, to the battlefields of the 1991 Gulf War. A terrible legacy of that war is coming to light, and it is called depleted uranium. Here is Robert Fisk.
Let me take you back to the immediate aftermath of the 1991 war in Iraq and to something that many of us journalists fear will happen over again. In February of 1991, Saddam's army had been driven out of Kuwait. 10,000 of them at least were dead. His tanks, Saddam's tanks, were burning across hundreds of square miles. Oil fires, some set off by the Iraqis, others by the United States, turned the sky black. I noticed, going back through my files for this lecture to you tonight, that some of the pages of my notebooks from that time are marked by dirty brown stains. It had been raining oil. And of course, we now know that bombs and ground assaults had destroyed some of Iraq's poison gas depots. Then, 7 years later, in March of 1998, on a routine assignment to Baghdad, I noticed something very odd. It started with a chance meeting with Murtaza Saleh, an old friend of mine. I found her wearing a kind of turban hat, and she told me she had cancer. God knows, she told me, maybe the cause is whatever they bombed us with. But she was a chain smoker. Her tragedy seemed a normal one. But then it turned out that her husband, a medical doctor, had died of prostate cancer, and 3 other family members had also died of cancer, some with no history of the disease. With 2 colleagues, I travelled down to the border with Kuwait. The last tank battles had been fought here, not in the desert, as many of us had thought at the time, but in open farmland. There were tomato fields and cows grazing in long grass and small rivers, and among them were the scorched remnants of those Iraqi tanks so pulverised by American A-10 jets 7 years earlier. I still cannot remember the exact time I heard the phrase depleted uranium. As you may know, depleted uranium is a radioactive and chemically toxic nuclear waste. During the process of making fuel for nuclear weapons or power plants, the isotope uranium-235 is separated from uranium. The remaining uranium-238 is called depleted and is now routinely used in the manufacture of an armor-piercing projectile. It's called a depleted uranium penetrator. It is tough and very hard, and we used this weapon in the Gulf War. In the army, it's called DU. All over the desert, we reporters saw at the time Iraqi T-62 and T-72 tanks on fire. They were no match for the modern American and British battle tanks, and one reason was the DU warhead. It can go through the toughest armor. What actually happens is that the DU warhead bursts into flame and it hits its target, releasing as it does so an aerosol of uranium. The British Ministry of Defence acknowledges only a very low radiation hazard from this weapon, unless, of course, you happen to be the target, or in the area, or happen to be breathing in at the time. Some of the thousands of Western soldiers now suffering from what is known as Gulf War syndrome think differently about the British estimate. So do thousands of Iraqis. An American military document states that significant concentrations of DU oxide dust could be expelled from the fire in the event of an explosion after an appreciable amount of DU has been oxidized. Keeping out of the downwind plume or wearing a self-contained breathing apparatus will provide adequate protection. Well, they didn't tell us that at the time. Now here comes a quotation from a classified, i.e. secret, British government report on the use of DU in the Gulf War. Radioactive hazards from the use of DU munitions, it says, can become a long-term problem if not dealt with in peacetime, and are a risk to both the military and the civilian population. It would be unwise for people to stay close to large quantities of DU for long periods, and this would obviously be of concern to the local population if they collect this heavy metal and keep it. Inhalation of airborne DU dust particles can lead to unacceptable body burdens. DU can also be a danger if taken into the body by ingestion or through a cut. If DU gets into the food chain or water, this will create potential health problems. Again, the whole issue of DU has been effectively deleted from our narrative of the 1991 Gulf War, as surely as it is expunged from any discussion today of the munitions we will use if we invade Iraq. As usual, and more than ever, we are prevented from knowing the truth. That is what this past year has brought us to. A war fought in secrecy by both sides. A series of covert struggles of flagrantly breached international laws and covenants. Is Osama bin Laden still alive? Unknown, until he sends us an audio tape. Is Mullah Omar still alive? Unknown. Who is detained in Guantanamo Bay? Identities publicly undisclosed. From which countries were they brought? Unknown. Numbers of men arrested in Pakistan and illegally taken to the US base at Bagram in Afghanistan? Unknown. Identity of Muslims held in American custody after September the 11th? Unknown. Gas used by Russian forces to subdue Chechen gunmen and gunwomen in Moscow? Unknown at first, even when more than 100 of the theater hostages died from it. And all the while, the vicious war between Palestinians and Israelis has been allowed to continue. Blind to this terrible struggle, President Bush, as I said, spent much of this year trying to foster the next war. The US oil companies were also planning to move in on the southern Iraqi oil fields, along presumably with British Petroleum, in the aftermath of war, while Washington sought Russia's aid for its Security Council resolution against Iraq by offering oil concessions to replace those Moscow bought from Saddam. In the real world, this is called a bribe. But what else should we expect from an administration whose members are so deeply involved in the oil business? Bush was an oil man, Cheney was an oil man, Rice is an oil lady. Indeed, Chevron, as some of you will know, launched a supertanker during the year called the Condoleezza. One might wonder if Al-Qaeda noticed that, but instead they chose the French tanker Limburg and tried to turn it into a fireball off the coast of Yemen. The method of ramming the vessel with a tiny explosive-packed boat was the same as that used against the USS Cole in Aden Harbor. It only served to remind us of just what this current war is about. The great black greasy liquid, which just 100 years ago used to be cursed by Saudi shepherds because their goats drowned in the stuff. William Safire, the New York Times' most right-wing columnist, who is well connected to both the Bush administration and personally to Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, gave the game away, I thought, in a remarkable article last month. The government of New Iraq, he wrote, would reimburse the United States and Britain for much of their costs in the war, and transitional government out of future oil revenues and contracts. We're very grateful to the future government. The evolving democratic government of New Iraq, quote, would repudiate the corrupt $8 billion debt that Russia claims was run up by Saddam. Even more disturbing to President Putin, according to Mr. Safire, will be the heavy investment to be made by the US and British companies that will sharply increase the drilling and refining capacity of the only nation, Iraq, whose oil reserves rival those of Russia, Saudi Arabia, and Mexico. So there you have it. Of course, we were told it was about weapons of mass destruction. Mr. Bush, as we know, played fast and loose with this in several speeches, and the New York Times reporter who pointed this out is now the subject of a smear campaign from the White House. Tony Blair produced a so-called 50-page dossier. We love dossiers in Britain in our stories. He produced a dossier, that's what he called it, of which only 15 pages actually talked about such weapons. And even then, it was spliced with coulds and mights and ifs and perhaps and probablys. The only worry was that if Saddam did have such weapons, he might actually use them on the invading Westerners. The other great concern of our leaders was Saddam's human rights abuses. Once again, they trotted out the same mantra: torture, rape, chemical weapons used even on his own people. And it's all true. But torture was in full swing in the early 1980s. And what was Washington doing then? Why, President Reagan was sending weapons to Baghdad in Saddam's war against Iran. I've actually met the German arms dealer who carried the first satellite air reconnaissance American pictures of the Iranian front line from the Pentagon to Baghdad. When Saddam was using gas on the Iranian army against all the rules of war, Reagan even sent an envoy to reopen the US embassy in Baghdad. And I'm sure some of you know the name of the man who was sent to shake Saddam's hand. His name was Donald Rumsfeld. Needless to say, the American television boys didn't waste their time this year quizzing the old boy who was thundering on about Saddam's human rights record. And just for that record, the very same Donald Rumsfeld was meeting Saddam's number two, Tariq Aziz, the following year, on the very day the UN published a damning report on Iraq's use of poison gas. And all the while, President Bush has been lecturing us on international politics, in particular, the need for the United Nations to avoid the ignominious collapse of the pre-war League of Nations. Across America, Mr. Bush was telling us all that the United Nations is in danger of becoming no more than the old League, which he described as a talking shop. Would that he looked at a history book now and again. Mr. Bush would find that the League of Nations failed the world because of the very same cynicism and disregard for morality by the major powers that the major powers, including the United States, show today towards the UN. The League, about which Mr. Bush has spoken so much, was formed in the aftermath of the 1914-18 war. President Woodrow Wilson of the United States was one of its midwives. Indeed, it was really his conception. He wanted, President Wilson, to protect minority rights, to give people independence. His 12 points were an inspiration to all the would-be nations of the world. He demanded a new international order, shades of George Bush Sr., and an equality of nations. Europe is being liquidated, General Smuts announced in 1918, and the League of Nations must be the heir to this great estate. And so came into being a new Poland, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, a reshaped Europe, and of course, a new Middle East. The modern state of Iraq, Mr. Bush, please note, owes its creation to the League, whose British and French mandates gave us, for better or worse, probably worse, Palestine and Syria and Lebanon. Others wanted states too. The Kurds wanted a state. The Armenians wanted to reverse their genocide by the Turks and return to homes in Turkey. But President Wilson fell ill. The US Congress declined to join the League, and the United States turned to an isolationism from which it would only be driven after Pearl Harbor, and after, Mr. Bush, please note again, two very profitable wartime years of neutrality. The Americans wanted no part of the League. The future superpower whose influence for peace would have been so beneficial to the world and whose growing economic and military might could have made Hitler revise his plans, turn their backs on the League. America would not participate. The Kurds got no state. The Armenians never went home. The other great powers joined the League. The French wanted it to be powerful, to have a multinational military force, not unlike today's UN peacekeepers. But the British, who wanted to remain the world's first superpower, turned the idea down. The first real test came from Japan. Our future World War II enemy proposed a clause in the League's covenant embracing the concept of racial equality. Wilson's own advisor, for the Americans were still keen to join the League at this stage, turned his back on the idea. It would, he said, quote, raise the race issue throughout the world. In the end, the race issue was only allowed to intrude when the League wished to demand the protection of minorities in the smaller new states created after the First World War. Minorities in Poland and Czechoslovakia came under the League's care. Major states did not have to worry about such provisions. Hence, when Hitler started persecuting the Jews of Germany after 1933, the League was powerless. In 1923, without British support for a League army, the French occupied the Rhineland to force Germany to pay wartime reparations. So individual states began to ignore the League. Italy's invasion of Abyssinia and the Spanish Civil War proved its worthlessness. Under Hitler, who was certainly not interested in an equality of nations, Germany abandoned the League. The Soviets, surprisingly, continued to support it. Sanctions on Spain did not end the Civil War. America stayed out. Little nations tried to sway the giants at that time. When he was president of the League's Council, the forerunner of our present-day Security Council, Eamon de Valera of Ireland proposed a League multinational force to stop Italy's 1935 aggression. He was prepared to commit his own new and tiny Irish army to such a project, much as the Irish army now plays such a prominent role in UN peacekeeping. The major powers were not interested. We have been unable to bend our wills to sacrifice selfish advantage when it conflicts with justice to others, de Valera later complained. By 1939, he was accurately referring to the League as debris. George Bush Jr. implies that the United Nations will also be debris if it doesn't come to heel and constantly follow America's demand to invade Iraq through UN resolutions. He wants to use it for his own project of regime change, which will change the map of the Middle East. We are supposed to believe that this is about weapons of mass destruction and forget that the US sold botulinum toxin, anthrax and gas gangrene and vials of West Nile virus to Iraq between 1985 and 1989. For most of that time, Iraq, of course, was fighting Iran, a war which the UN had tried to end. So why should Saddam have any respect for the UN? The Americans care no more about Israel's failure to adhere to UN resolutions than France cared about the League when it entered the Rhineland, or when Italy invaded Abyssinia, Ethiopia today, of course. It is the major powers that govern the UN, and they will use it or abuse it as they see fit. In an odd way, the US administration, which for years, of course, failed to pay its dues to the world body, is right to raise the ghost of the League of Nations. For it was the cynicism and arrogance of the major powers that destroyed the League of Nations, just as we may well destroy the UN today. And what about Oslo? What about the famous peace process? Whoever invented that phrase, I don't know. The famous peace process between Israelis and Arabs, which now lies in ruins. Just briefly, I think we should examine what really happened. In 1991, you may remember, Arabs and Israelis were invited to Madrid to discuss a peace agreement based on UN Security Council resolutions 242 and 338. And as I'm sure we all recall, 242 calls for the withdrawal of Israeli forces from territory captured in the 1967 war, the occupied West Bank, Gaza and Golan, in return for the security of the states in the area, including Israel. It also reaffirmed that territory could not be acquired through war. But the Oslo Agreement between Israel and the PLO effectively allowed Israel to renegotiate 242. Under Oslo, Israel would decide which bits of territory it would return to the Arabs and which bits it would keep. Illegal Jewish settlements continued to expand on still occupied land in defiance of international law. The system of Palestinian control over one area, Area A, joint control over Area B, and Israeli control over Area C, meant that the occupied territories, as we know, were razored up to bits. All the most contentious issues, Jerusalem, the so-called right of return, the future of the settlements, were left to final status talks, as if a newly married couple could be forced to love and trust one another, providing they were first forced to live together. In the meanwhile, a whole slew of other agreements were entered into, and not one of them was respected. For the record, I'm going to tell you what happened. The details are complex, but it's worth getting them on the record. The Oslo II Taba Agreement, concluded by Yitzhak Rabin in September 1995, promised three Israeli withdrawals from Zone A and Zone C to be completed by October of 1997. The final status agreement was to be completed by October 1999, by which time occupation was supposed to have ended. Interim accords went against the Palestinians. In January of 1997, a handful of settlers were granted 20% of central Hebron, despite the fact that Oslo committed Israel to leave all West Bank towns. By October 1988, Israel had not carried out the Taba Accords. Benjamin Netanyahu then negotiated a new agreement at Y River, which divided the second redeployment promised at Taba into two phases. He carried out only the first. Netanyahu promised to reduce Zone C from 72% Israeli control to 59%, transferring 41% of the West Bank to Zones A and B. In September 1999, Ehud Barak reneged on Y River, turning Netanyahu's two-phase withdrawal into three, the first of which would transfer only 7% from Zone C to Zone B. The details themselves are complex, but the facts of each reneging need to be on the record. Throughout this period, Jewish settlement expansion increased from a population of 80,000 to 150,000, despite Oslo's stricture that neither side could take unilateral steps. Yet each new agreement in the Oslo process was hailed by us reporters as a breakthrough, as a sign that the peace process had been put, that old cliché, back on track. As Oslo slowly collapsed, journalists reassured their readers and viewers that it was, if delayed, still alive, still leading towards the always elusive peace. Opponents of Oslo were regarded as being anti-peace and thus supporters of terrorism, which meant, of course, that few journalists were going to explain why Oslo was failing. When it became clear that the whole structure was about to fall into the abyss, both Israelis and Palestinians were invited to Camp David, where, so the journalists were informed by the Israelis and Americans, Arafat was offered 92% or 94%, 96% of the West Bank and Gaza. The figure is a myth. It meant 92% of whatever Israel would offer. Jerusalem was not included in the 92%, nor the huge Jewish settlements illegally built around East Jerusalem, which are now included in the limits of Israel's expanded and illegally annexed city. The 92% did include areas of the Dead Sea, hardly a viable piece of real estate for building houses, and an Israeli military buffer zone up to 10 miles deep. Take from this figure the settlement areas, which would have to be leased back to Israel for periods of 25 years, and the real figure that was being offered to Arafat, and my colleague Phil Reeves in Jerusalem and I spent 4 days looking at the maps, the real figure was nearer to 64%. Without Palestinian sovereign status over any part of East Jerusalem. Only a sort of status, a sort of sovereignty, rather, in Madeleine Albright's words, over certain Arab areas of East Jerusalem. And the right of return, never discussed in the media prior to the Camp David talks, was suddenly tossed out of the negotiations on the basis that everyone knew it would have to be sacrificed. In all this false reporting, we journalists were complicit. Arafat had thrown away the best chance of a state because he thought he'd get more land by refusing and turning to violence. That was the line, and when the inevitable explosion came, Arafat, of course, was to blame. He had, and here the journalistic narrative became even more inventive, he had turned to violence because he couldn't get what he wanted through negotiations. Arafat had returned to violence, to terrorism. This was the story. Not that the collapse of Oslo inevitably led to violence, but that violence destroyed the peace process. Which meant, as I wrote back in 1993, that the Arabs would be blamed and that Oslo was Arafat's road to ruin. So what's been happening to us in the months since September the 11th, 2001? You know, we spent decades preaching to the Third World, preaching to China and the Soviet Union, to Black Africa and to the Arabs about law, democracy, human rights and fair trials. But the moment our glittering towers were struck, we tore up, I think, all these old lectures, imprisoned hundreds on suspicion, brought prisoners drugged and blindfolded to Guantanamo Bay, bombed the poorest country in the world, and killed thousands of its citizens. As I said, in any ordinary crime, even domestic crime, the first thing the cops do is look for the motive, and here we cannot. What are we to learn of the personal reasons for the crimes against humanity of September the 11th? Not much. The middle-class murderers left only one infantile statement. Their message was their deed. But it came from the Middle East. It came from a land that has been deceived and mistreated and humiliated for decades. Was the world really changed forever? I don't believe it. Perhaps America has changed. But why should the world be changed? Back in 1982, during that same invasion of Lebanon, 17,500 people, almost all of them civilians, were killed in just 3 months, and I saw many of the thousands of bodies with my own eyes. In Syria, in February of the same year, up to 20,000 Syrians were killed in the Islamist uprising in the city of Hama by Syrian special forces, run by Rifat al-Assad, brother of the then president, Hafez. But no one lit candles for the dead of Hama or Lebanon. There were no church services here, no one remembered, and the world did not change. Now, in the fall of last year, I heard Colin Powell telling us from Louisburg University that never again can we look up into the pale blue sky and see an airliner and feel the same way about it. I think this is rubbish. I look up every day. I look up every day. I look up every day from my home in Beirut, from my balcony. I see planes flying over me. They land at Beirut Airport. I fly on a lot more planes than Secretary Powell, and they all take me to my destination. You know, without in any way belittling the horror and the real evil of that terrible day, September 11th, I do sometimes wonder whether America's concentration on that one day, to the point where we cannot discuss the whys, isn't becoming a form of dangerous self-absorption. So can we journalists ignore the abuse and the lobby groups and the attempt to soft-pedal our reporting about the Middle East? White House spokesman Ari Fleischer's remark in October of last year that the press is asking a lot of questions that I suspect the American people would prefer not to be asked or answered carried its own ominous implications. And when the head of CNN announced to his reporters that they should not say too much about the thousands of Afghan civilian casualties of American bombing, because this might provide propaganda for the Taliban, it was, I think, the most shameful comment made by a Western news head in recent times. Ladies and gentlemen, may I make an appeal? Let's stop saying that September the 11th, 2001, changed the world. Let's not go to war for human rights crimes when we didn't care about it 19 years ago. Let's always ask the why question. Let's do what Americans used to tell their journalists to do. Let's tell it how it is. Thank you for your patience tonight.
That was Robert Fisk, war and Middle East correspondent for the London-based Independent. He spoke in Berkeley, California, in the First Congregational Church in November 2002. From Beirut, Lebanon, where he has lived for almost a quarter century, Fisk travels into North Africa and as far as Pakistan and the former Yugoslavia. In addition to filing several stories a week, he makes documentary films in conjunction with the BBC and wrote Pity the Nation, a book about Lebanon. You can find more information on Robert Fisk on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information on how to order a copy of Robert Fisk's talk on Iraq by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Moriah Gilardin. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.